The Pat Kenny Show.
With the Jaguar E-Pace. Beautiful by design and dynamic to drive. Delivering performance that is unmistakably Jaguar.
This is News Talk.
In the past 24 hours, some of the great political leaders of our time have paid tribute to the late SDLP leader, Nobel Prize winner John Hume, who passed away yesterday morning at the age of 83. Well, last night I spoke to former US President Bill Clinton, who of course worked closely with John Hume over many years in pursuit of peace in Northern Ireland. And I began by asking President Clinton what his first thoughts were when he heard the news of John Hume's death.
Well, I said a silent prayer of thanks for his life. You know, he's had a rough time of it the last couple of years or so, but what a great life he had, and how much good he did, and what a good heart he had. I thought about all that and how much I wish we had more people speaking from the heart for human unity instead of working for the head to divide people, which seems to be the order of the day in altogether too many countries today.
It's interesting that during the week, of course, you attended the funeral of John Lewis, that great civil rights leader. And you recall civil rights in remembering John Hume in describing him as our Martin Luther King Jr.
Yeah, he was. He was, you know, and I knew John Lewis very well for a long, long time. And he and John had a lot in common. They never lost touch with ordinary people and what the day-to-day concerns of life are. And they put themselves on the line and fought hard for what they believed in. But they never felt the need to demonize people who disagreed with them. And so they always left open space for working together. And that's a great characteristic, I think.
Have you
and hard to memories, do under a lot of pressure.
Have you early memories of meeting John either as candidate Clinton or as President Clinton?
Oh, sure. Well, first of all, I knew a lot about him before I ever met him, but I think we met early in my presidency, and we met many times over those 8 years, and then after I left office, I continued to stay in touch with him and always do what I could whenever I was in Ireland or Northern Ireland to keep pushing on the remaining issues in the peace negotiations. But I do remember when I first saw him, I thought, this is a guy who looks like his public image. That is, he looked like a man with a good heart who had clear convictions but didn't feel the need to demonize and debase other people. And that's the way he looked, with his wavy hair and his kind of sly smile. I thought, and it's the way he behaved.
And the way he, at the same time, yeah, he was a political operator. I mean, he was the guy who understood that the U.S. had a great relationship with Ireland. The U.S. had a great relationship with Great Britain. And yet there were animosities, if you like, between their two friends. And he thought, well, why not get the U.S. involved between the warring parties, if you like?
Yeah, and, you know, the U.K. was under John Major was very much against it. And and even our own State Department was against it. But I thought it was the right thing to do, and John did, and he encouraged me to consider this. And the more I looked at it, the more I realized that somebody needed to be in there that could represent, in effect, both communities and care about a resolution of the conflict. And he had a lot to do with that, and he, of course, had cultivated, long before I showed up, a lot of very good relationships in American political life. And I think most of the American politicians he'd worked with, for example, agreed with him when he decided to support a visa for Gerry Adams, which the then Prime Minister of Ireland, Albert Reynolds, was also for. But some of them didn't. And I thought he made a lot of sense. He said, you know, his commitment to nonviolence was never in question. But he said, you know, we've gotten to the point now where I really think we can get something done if we can get everybody to the table. He had a sense of it that I think sometimes the people in more prominent political positions might have missed.
Now, that was your decision in January of 1994 to grant Gerry Adams that first visa, which allowed him to come to the United States, with lots of provisos attached. You know, he couldn't do any fundraising, he was limited in time and so on. But were you getting a lot of kickback from Capitol Hill against that decision?
Well, I was. The Friends of Ireland on Capitol Hill were divided. You know, some of them were very strongly for the visa for Gerry. Some of them, including the then Speaker of the House, Tom Foley, had their reservations. And they were sensitive to how intensely the British government at the time was against it. So, you know, we had to weave and bob a little bit to at least show we were sensitive to all this. I was not about to give up America's historic relationship with the UK, but I just thought they were dead wrong about this. I thought that the size of the Irish diaspora and the level of commitment to peace in the United States were so great that it was a bad mistake to take America out of play just at the moment when we might be able to get something done. And I really thought we were helping the government, even though at the time the John Major's government didn't think I should do it. Remember that Major, at considerable risk to himself, because he needed the unionist politicians to hold his majority in Parliament, had made that agreement with Albert Reynolds on general principles and how to proceed. So I thought the time was right, and John did. And, you know, the fact that he was for it, when his commitment to nonviolence had never been remotely questioned, had a huge impact, influence on me. It made it a lot easier to do what I thought was the right thing to do.
Were you aware at the time, you know, how long he'd been talking to Gerry Adams privately and the kind of moves that Gerry Adams was indicating, if circumstances were right, that the IRA might declare a ceasefire, which ultimately happened, and lay down their arms, which by and large is said to have happened?
Well, until this decision had to be made, he didn't say much to me or anybody else because he didn't want to betray the confidence. One of the things that made everybody trust him was he didn't betray confidence. And but when the decision had to be made, it was clear to me, and he made it clearer, that he'd been in touch with him, with Gerry Adams and with people representing Sinn Féin and the IRA, and he thought they were, under the right circumstances, ready to move. And that's, he gave me a lot of confidence because that was my instinct, but he'd been working on it a lot harder than I had for a lot longer than I had.
I mean, going back a bit, he got the so-called four horsemen on side: Senator Ted Kennedy, Speaker Tip O'Neill, Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, Congressman Hugh Carey. So he'd obviously done the spade work. I mean, he was in the trenches on the Hill getting people on side.
He was. And as I said, by then there were a lot of other members of Congress who were interested too. Richie Neal and Jim McGovern, Marty Meehan, and the New York Irish in Congress, including a couple of Republicans, especially Peter King and Congressman McHugh, who later became Secretary of the Army. All these people had been, I think they, many of them were on record as resolutely against the attacks of the IRA, but they were also resolutely in favor of a better deal for the Catholic community in Northern Ireland and some sort of reconciliation. And I think finally they realized there was no way this whole thing was going to get resolved unless all the major factions were part of the resolution. And, you know, I give a lot of credit to the members in Congress who were particularly active on this.
Every American president wants a successful foreign policy initiative, if possible, during their 4 or 8 years. When the IRA ceasefire collapsed in 1996 and we had the Canary Wharf bombing, did you think for a moment, oh my God, I have backed the wrong horse here?
Never. Never. Partly for pure sort of reasons of calculation, that is, there was the Canary Wharf bombing. But they set off that bomb in a place at a time when it was likely to have minimum damage. Now, unlike, for example, the Omaha bombing. Mm-hmm. This was, the Canary Wharf bombing was more like, let me send a message here. I don't agree with it, but it could have been a lot worse if they had chosen to make it so. And I thought they were almost signaling that they did not want to give up on the peace process. And so I never for a moment thought we were going to lose it. And I was also got it in that by the fact that from David Trimble and Jerry Adams, as well as all the other major players, they were basically where John Hume was. We've got to keep going, and we don't need to go back to violence.
You know what they say, cometh the hour, cometh the man, and we had a very interesting confluence of personalities. You had the young Labour Prime Minister, Tony Blair, the young American President, Bill Clinton, the young Irish Taoiseach in Bertie Ahern. You had Jerry Adams there, and you had David Trimble, who it might have been expected would be the thorn in the side of the whole thing. And yet somehow, on Good Friday 1998, it happened.
It did happen. And, you know, it was not free for David Trimble. It probably cost him the leadership of the unionists after the agreement was made. But, boy, he complained a lot about it when he needed to, but he was there when we needed him, and I always will be grateful to him for that. And again, I think this also is something I have to say for John Hume. He was always keeping in touch with everybody, always there to give the right nudge, you know.
Well, and he also it appears, also had to do a lot of nudging in those last hours, making important phone calls. I'm sure you were constantly in touch with John.
Yeah, I talked to everybody in the last, when we were running out of time, I stayed up virtually all night and got up early the next morning, just left an hour or two or something, but it all worked out.
Your abiding memories of John then, because, I mean, as well as being a politician, a humanitarian, a peacemaker, he also was a great personality. I've no doubt that you share a drop or two with him.
Well, first of all, I could sit and listen to him tell his stories all night long. You know, I love listening to him tell not only stories of what had happened in the peace process, but just the stories of his life. And, you know, he'd give me the whole history of Derry. And he was very provincial in that one way. He always insisted, you know, that we had to have a big event early on in Derry once we got the ceasefire. And we had that wonderful night there when I came to turn on the Christmas lights in Belfast and then to go down to Dublin. He said, nothing would do, John, but I had to come to Derry. And he was right about it. It was a great thing to do. But my abiding memories of him personally are as, you know, a wonderful storyteller, a person who cared about people as people and not just as political objects, and a person who really could be totally persistent and tough in what he believed, but was fundamentally motivated by love for his fellow Irish men and women, whether they were with him or not every day. I mean, we had so much fun. I thought that you know, the last thing we did together, I think, in public was walk across the Peace Bridge in 2016. And by then, I've been out of office for a long time. But we'd continue to work. Hillary also did. We'd come to Ireland. We'd give speeches for John or somebody else and just do whatever we could to keep pushing. But we were walking across that bridge, and I thought it was so interesting. Martin McGuinness was with us, and he was a classic example of John never giving up on anybody, because what a remarkable life he had and how quickly he turned it around. And he was so effective, and it was obvious that he, to me, cared very much for John, and as I did. I remember always a night I shared with John and Pat, and I could never get enough of trying to soak up his fundamental good nature. And besides, he was funny.
He was that too. You mentioned there, Pat, his wonderful, wonderful wife, lover, friend, confidant, and in later years, gatekeeper to protect John from unwelcome attentions. And I must say, my heart goes out to Pat today on the loss of John, and I'm sure yours does too.
Oh, yes. I talked to her a couple of hours ago, and we had a really nice visit. We lived old times, and I think she knew that he had come to the end of his journey and was very, very grateful for the life they had together.
Well, President Clinton, it's been called the peace process, and I suppose we should remember it's not the finished article. It's a process that is ongoing. And I think the greatest legacy that John... Yeah, the greatest legacy John could have is that the process continues.
I agree. And I think if you look at the consequences to Northern Ireland and to the Irish Republic and to the relationships between the UK and Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland, it's a great rebuke to what has been the dominant political argument of the last 4 years, which is the only thing that matters is division. The only thing that matters is what is different about us, and it's so much more important than anything we could possibly have in common. That's what all this sort of ultra-nationalism is about, particularly when it's joined with either religious or racial and ethnic differences. And you've seen it all over the world, and it's left us with a mess. If you look at the legacy of the peace process and its aftermath, with all of its warts and all of its imperfections and all of its unresolved issues, it did not leave a mess. It left a march of progress, a decline in violence, and a better future for all the children of Northern Ireland. So it seems to me people who really respected and loved and valued John Hume should be grateful for what he did, but also should be mindful that if we were following that model in the world today, we'd be doing better on everything from our political differences to our economic inequality to our management of this global health epidemic. We just got to have an outstretched hand instead of a clenched fist. I always think of that when I think of John Hume. No matter what kind of fight he was in, he had a smile on his face and his hand was reaching out to shake yours. And he was so good at it. I told him I said, John, if you hadn't been such a good politician, you'd have been a great pickpocket. Because it was easy to lose yourself looking into those eyes of his, and they were sparkling, and he had his smile on, and he was telling his tales. But he was a great man and a model for what we should get back to in the world today.
On that happy note, President Bill Clinton, thank you very much for joining us with your thoughts on your friend as well as fellow politician John Hume. Thank you very much.
Thank you.